Parshas Naso, okay, we have the following. Something that the Rabbeinu Yosef Bechor Shor says. Right before the Mishkan is erected and dedicated, Chanukah HaMizbeach, which dedicated the Mizbeach when the fire came down on the Mizbeach, and that represented God's presence descending into the Mishkan, which was the whole goal of the Mishkan, that God's presence should descend there and then spread out amongst the Jewish people who resided around the Mishkan. So before that, there are a few different parshios, a few different paragraphs, a few different subjects that the Torah speaks about. The first one being sending the people who are tamei, who are defiled, out of the camp. Now, sending them out of the camp was not uniform, that all people who were defiled had to go out of all the camps. There were three camps. The first camp was called Machne Shechina, the camp of God. That included the Mishkan. The Mishkan itself was Machne Shechina. Okay? We'll see in one second how that corresponds to what we have today, or had in the time of the Beis HaMikdash. So the Mishkan itself was Machne Shechina. Then there was Leviim, who camped around the Mishkan. That was called Machne Leviya. That was the camp of the Leviim around the Mishkan. And then there was Machne Yisrael. Then there was the camp of the rest of the Jewish people who camped around the Leviim. So you have three camps. In the center was Machne Shechina. Around that was Machne Leviya, and then was Machne Yisrael. Okay? Corresponding today to the Tower of Beis HaMikdash, the Azorah, the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash, and further in, the Heichal, the Kodesh HaKadoshim, was Machne Shechina. That corresponded to the Mishkan. Okay, the Azorah and the Heichal and the Kodesh HaKadoshim, that was called Machne Shechina. Then there was Machne Leviya, that was the Har HaBayis, the Temple Mount, up until the walls of the Azorah, was Machne Leviya. That was the camp of the Leviya. Corresponded to that second camp, that was the whole Temple Mount. From the walls of the Temple Mount, which is like the coastal of Maravi, inward till the walls of the temple itself. And then, within the walls of Yerushalayim, till the walls of the Temple Mount, that was called Machne Yisrael. And in addition, every city that had a wall around it in the time of Yoshua, even though it didn't have a wall after that, the wall was subsequently destroyed, but it had a wall in the time of Yoshua, that was also called Machne Yisrael. Walled cities were also called Machne Yisrael. Unwalled cities didn't have a din of Machne Yisrael because they weren't a machane. That'd be a camp. Camp means they have a wall around them. So if they were walled cities, they were called Machne Yisrael. Unwalled cities, not. Now, there are three kinds of tumah, three kinds of defilement. And each one was sent out of a different number of camps. The least tumah, and you would think just the opposite, the least tumah was tumas mace. Person who was defiled to the dead, and even a dead body himself, was only not allowed to be in Machne Shechina. Couldn't enter the Azorah, couldn't enter the Beis HaMikdash, or the Mishkan. But Machne Leviya, a dead body, and a person who was defiled to a dead body could be there. The proof was Moshe Rabbeinu carried with him the Aron of Yosef in his Machne. He was in Machne Leviya. That means that corresponding to that was the Har HaBayis, right, the Temple Mount. A person who is Tamei Nes is allowed to be on the Temple Mount. If you're just defiled to the dead, you're allowed to go up to the Temple Mount. We'll see in one second. But you can't go into the Azorah, you can't go into the confines of the Beis HaMikdash. Okay? So that is called a Tamei Nes. A Tamei Nes is sent out of one camp. He can only not be in Machne Shechina, but he's allowed to remain in Machne Leviya or Machne Yisrael. Then there's a second degree of tumah. That's tumah yotze migufo. Tumah that emanates from your body because of an emission. For a man or a woman. A balkeri, a zav, a nida, a zava. Tumah that emanates from the bodily secretions of the body that make a person tummy, man or a woman. They have to stay out of two machnos. They can't go into Machne Shechina. They can't go into the Mishkan or into the Beis HaMikdash. Nor can they be in Machne Leviya, in the camp of the Leviyim, or corresponding to the Har HaBayis. They can't go up to the Har HaBayis. A woman who was a Nida could not be on any place in Har HaBayis until she became Tohar. A man who was a Zav, a Balkeri, right, could not go up to Har HaBayis either. And the last, the worst of the three kinds of tumors are Metzora, a leper. His tumor is the worst. He cannot be in the Beis HaMikdash or in the Mishkan, that's Machne Shechina. He can't be in Machne Leviya or on the Temple Mount. He can't even be within the confines of the city of Yerushalayim or in any other walled city. He has to be outside of every walled city, including Yerushalayim, until he finishes being a Metzora. So those are the three. Kol Tzarua, the Kol Zav, the Kol Tomei LeNefesh. There's the Tzarua, who's the worst. He has to go out of all three camps. There is the Zav, who is lesser, who only has to go out of two camps. And then there's the Tomei LeNefesh, the person who's defiled to a dead body. He only has to go out of one camp, the Mokom HaShchin. I'm going to leave my discussion of going up on the Temple Mount for a little while, okay, as a parenthetical asterisk. I want to finish the idea here. After this, sending out these people who are Tomei, the Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor explains, why is this in Parshas Nasa? Because since the Mishkan is going to be dedicated and God's presence is going to dwell amongst us, it's not proper that defiled people should be within the camp of people who are like angels who reside around God. And the different levels of Tumah make them farther and farther away from that camp of people who are godly. Okay, now, there are other parshios after that, three other parshios that are after this sending out the defiled people that precede also Birkas Kohanim and the dedication of the Mishkan. What are they? Gezel Hagir, the parsha, if you steal for anybody, and you deny that you stole and you swore falsely. You deny that you stole and you swore falsely, and then you admitted that you swore falsely and you really did steal. Then it's not enough just to make restitution and return what you stole, which is normally what you do. You have to bring a sacrifice in Asham. You have to give back what you stole, and you have to add an extra fifth as an atonement. Since you swore falsely, right, and so it makes the sin much greater, you need an Asham, Karen, and Chomesh. You have to return what you stole, you have to add a fifth of its value, and you have to also bring a sacrifice, an Asham. That's called an Asham Zeros. What if you stole from a gear, a convert? So let's say you stole from a regular person, he died. So you make restitution to his heirs. What if he's a gear and he has no heirs? He has no children and he has no relatives, because every time a person converts, he has no more relatives. Even if his relatives convert with him, they're each considered themselves. And if he has no children, he has no heirs. Every other Jew has some heir, a brother, an uncle, a cousin, something. But this gear has nobody. And now you stole from the gear, you swore falsely, and now you admit it. So you have to make restitution. There's nobody to make restitution to, because the gear is dead, and he has no heirs. So the Torah says, you still have to give that thing that you stole back, give it to the Kohen. The Kohen will accept it in place of the gear. That's called Gezel HaGer. That's the first parasha. Then there's another parasha, that's the parasha of Sota, a woman who is suspected of committing adultery, so she has to go through this whole ordeal to prove her innocence. Okay, and just as an aside, because the women always think this is not fair, a guy gets up in the morning and he says, hey, I think my wife committed adultery, and he brings her to the Kohen, and she has to go through this terrible, terrible ordeal to prove that she's innocent. It's not what happens. A man can't just say, hey, I think my wife committed adultery, and put her through this ordeal. It's meaningless if he just thinks she committed adultery without any grounds. What's talking about in the Torah is a specific case only, where a man saw that his wife is getting too friendly with somebody, and he warned her in front of witnesses. He warned her and he said in front of two witnesses, I want you not to be alone with that man. Now, she's not allowed to be alone with that man anyway, because the Torah prohibits yichud. No woman is allowed to be alone with a man who's not her husband, and no man is allowed to be alone with a woman who's not his wife, except if it's his mother or his daughter, or there's a lot of men around or a lot of women. But alone, one-on-one, right, is yichud. It's total prohibition. So anyway, she couldn't be alone with this guy. Right? So if she was alone with him without her husband warning, she also transgressed the Torah. So what? Yeah, him too. Fine. What? For who? It doesn't apply to a man, but there's a reason why. I'll tell you in a second. Let's do one thing at a time. In any case, so now this man warns his wife, I don't want you to be alone with this woman. Okay? And if, and now she ignores his warning, and she locks herself in a hotel room with this guy, and there are two witnesses who witness that they locked themselves in the hotel room. We don't know what went on behind the closed doors. Now the husband has the right to say there's grounds to think that they weren't playing checkers, right? And something not nice happened behind those closed doors. He warned her. She was over a total prohibition of being alone with this man, and there were witnesses to the fact. Okay, the witnesses don't know what happened behind the closed doors. Now, since no witnesses saw them commit adultery, there's not going to be any penalty. There's not going to be any death penalty over here. Not going to be any penalty. Because you need witnesses who saw the sin and warned them in order to give somebody a death penalty. And if there were witnesses that saw them, right, they walked into the room and they caught them committing adultery, then both the man and the woman get killed. Right? The man who committed adultery and the woman who he committed adultery with get killed. It makes no difference if the man is a married man or he's a single man. He lived with a married woman. And he committed adultery, they both get killed. That's even between men and women. They both get killed if they committed adultery. Right? Both partners. But we don't know if she committed adultery. Now, let's say she doesn't want to go through this ordeal. So all she has to say is one of two things. Yes, I'm guilty. If she admits that she's guilty, we don't punish her. Because we can't punish her without witnesses on her own admission. The only thing that happens to her is she has to get divorced. She can no longer live with her husband, and she can never marry the man that she's suspected of living with. That's all. She can marry anybody else, right, and live a nice life. She has to get divorced from her husband, and she can never marry the man that she's suspected of committing. That's the only thing that happens to her. So she admits guilt, nothing happens. She has to get divorced, that's it. She can also say, I'm not guilty, but I don't want to go through this ordeal. Then also she gets divorced, that's it. That's it. What if she says, I'm innocent, and I want to remain married? I don't want to get divorced. I want to prove my innocence. Then she has the right to go through this ordeal, and if she survives it, right, then she's innocent. And the Torah itself testifies to her innocence, and the husband's not allowed to suspect her anymore, 100% kosher woman, and not only that, she gets rewarded. Because she believed in this, and she went through the ordeal to prove her innocence, if she never had children, she'll have children. If she had children with difficulty, she won't have any difficulty. If she had weak children, she'll have strong children. She'll get some reward. Okay, that's it. So this whole ordeal is not to hurt the woman. Because if she's guilty, all she has to do is admit she's guilty, and that's it. Nothing happens to her. If she's not guilty, but she doesn't want to go through the ordeal, that's her prerogative. All she has to do is get divorced. The only time she has to go through the ordeal is if she gave reason to suspect her by being alone with somebody after her husband warned her, and she chooses to go through the ordeal. Okay, that's in parentheses. Why doesn't it apply to a man? To the banishah. If the man's a married man, not a married man, or if the man lived with a married woman, so he'll get the death penalty too. Then it's equal. But if the man is married and the woman he lives with is not married, okay, then the Torah did not give a death penalty for a married man living with an unmarried woman. Even though he's a married man and he's living with somebody who's not his wife, that's not called adultery. Why? Very simply. Because a man is allowed to marry more than one woman from the Torah. So a married man living with another woman who's not his wife is really permitted from the Torah, if he would marry her. The only thing that's wrong with it is that he didn't marry her. That's a sin. But it's not a death penalty sin. A married woman is never allowed to live with another man unless she gets divorced or her husband dies. A married woman can only live with one man at a time, her husband. If she lives with another man, and it makes no difference if the man is married or unmarried. The main thing is the woman. So if it's a married man, a married man or an unmarried man who's living with this married woman, then he is, whatever happens to her, it's happened to him. If he's, what's it called, an unmarried woman, whether it's a married man or unmarried man, there's no death penalty. And the Rambam explains very simply why. The Torah gave a death penalty if anyone lives with a married woman, and no death penalty if a married man lives with an unmarried woman, right? And why is it okay for a man to marry more than one woman at a time, whereas a woman can't marry more than one man at a time? Why is the Torah discriminating against women or men? I don't know whichever you think is nice, right? But in any case, the Rambam says very simply, because the Torah wants people to know who their parents are. So if a man is married to many women, You always know who the mother is. She gave birth to the baby. And you always know who the father is. Only one man. But if a woman is married to more than one man, then every baby, this is the mother, and the father is one of the above. Right? That's not a great way to have a family. And my father is one of these people. Right? Right? It's like in certain communities, on Father's Day, they send to whom it may concern. Right? Those kind of communities are not exactly the most pure paragons of virtue and the great society. So Torah wanted Jews to know their fathers and their mothers. Okay, in any case. So that's the second parasha, Sota. And then comes the parasha of Nazir, the Nazirite. So I was thinking of developing this idea that these parashas had to precede the consecration of the Mishkan, because they represent the purity of the Jewish people. Just like sending out the Tomei people represents the Jewish people have to be pure, because we dwell around God. God dwells in our presence. So you don't want God to dwell in impure places. So you get rid of the people who are Tomei. Send them out till they become Tar, and then they can come back in, each one according to his degree. But I think there's a symbolic meaning to these people who are Tomei, and we'll see if they fit these other three parishes perfectly. First, there's the guy who is Tamei Nes. Let's start with the worst one. First is the Metzora. First person exists on three levels. Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, Bein Adam L'Atzmo, Bein Adam L'Makom. There are certain sins or mitzvahs that affect other people. Not only me, and not only my relationship to God, but my relationship to other people. Like stealing. I affect other people, I affect myself, and I affect my relationship with God if I steal. Three things. Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, Bein Adam L'Atzmo, Bein Adam L'Makom. Then there's certain sins that don't affect other people, that only affect me and my relationship to God. Eating treif affects me, makes me lesser of a person, and it affects my relationship with God, because I did something wrong, and I made my neshama not so great, and I can't have that good relationship with God. But it doesn't affect other people, right? If I eat treif, it doesn't affect my relationship with other people. It's Bein Adam L'Makom, not Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. And then there's certain things that are not really sins. So they don't affect me in a negative way, but they affect how I can relate to God more than just status quo. Extra. Those are sins that are purely Bein Adam L'Makom, not Bein Adam L'Asro. It's not even, it doesn't affect me personally. It affects only my relationship with God. What is that? That's like, oh, one second. Now what's representative of that? These three kinds of tumah. Mitzora is a guy who spoke Lashon Hara. He is bad to other people. He affects himself and he affects his relationship with God. So he has to leave all three camps. God's camp, the Levi's camp, which represents Namlechus Kohen and the Goy Kadosh, we have to be a holy nation. He's not holy. And the camp of Israel, because he affected other Jews. So he has to leave all three camps. Then there is the Zava, the person who has sexual problems. That usually doesn't affect other people, right? It's consenting adults. But it affects you and your relationship with God. So you have to leave two camps. Machne Levia, he's no longer a Mamleches Kohanim, the great Kadosh, he's not a holy person, and he has to leave God's camp because his relationship with God has been affected. And then there's a Tomei Lenefesh, a person who is defiled to the dead. It's not a sin to be defiled to the dead. You can do all the mitzvahs in the Torah when we're defiled to the dead. We do them today. We're all defiled to the dead. There's nothing wrong intrinsically with a person who's defiled with the dead. He hasn't done anything wrong. But it affects his greater relationship with God, because he can't eat sacrifices and he can't go into the Beis HaMikdash. So it only affects his relationship with God. It doesn't affect him personally and it doesn't affect other people. It affects his relationship with God. So he only has to go out of one camp, God's camp. But he can remain in Machne Levia and he can remain in Machne Yisrael. If you think about it, the three parshios that follow these three tumas, each one represents a different tuma. Gezel Hager, stealing from the ger, right, represents which sin? Like a Metzora. Somebody who's bad to other people, affects himself, and affects his relationship with God. So that's similar to sending out the Metzora from all three camps. Then there's the Sota. That's a sexual idea. And here's coming to tell me, not only do you have to send away the person who's no good, but even in a doubt, even the fine points of this, you have to make restitution, even to the ger, give it to the Kohen. You have to be completely free of any stealing. You have to be completely free of any sin between man and man. Not just he shouldn't be a sinner. You should be totally clean from any sin in the most subtle ways. Same thing with a sota. Not only shouldn't you be a lecher and a person who's immoral, but even the doubt, even where there's a doubt, a Jew has to be holy in these areas. That corresponds to the zov of the nida, the tumors that have to do with things that affect you and God but don't affect other people, like sexual sins. And lastly, is the nazir. The nazir is not a person who is doing anything wrong. He's doing extra holiness. He could be fine without being a nazir. He wants to be extra holy. That's like the tamei lenefesh. The person who's fine, but he can't have that extra holiness of going into the Beis HaMikdash and eating karbanos. So after we send away these three people who are tamei, the Torah gives us three parshiyos to tell us that it's not enough just not to have tumeim of these three levels amongst you, but you have to see that you conduct yourself in such a perfect way that you clear yourself totally of sins between man and man, totally between man and man, a man and himself and man and God, and totally make yourself holy, like a nazir, between man and God. And after that comes Birkas Kohanim. Now, if you're so pure, you deserve the blessing of the Kohanim, of perfection, and then God's presence can come amongst the Jewish people. That's how the Sedra is made up, and that's exactly as much time as we have. For a woman, yes, a woman can be a Nazira. She can't be a Nazira, but she can be a Nazira.